Well, last week we ventured fairly deeply into territory that may at first glance seem unnecessary, but in fact it is a needed piece of the puzzle to help us understand the goings-on in the book of Samuel. And that territory was the political landscape surrounding and directing so many of Samuel's and Saul's actions. Now, we're not going to rehash last week's lesson, but it's important that we set the stage for this evening's study by summarizing the current condition of the 12 tribes that faced the newly crowned king of Israel. Now, Israel was a deeply divided family. There were three distinct factions that formed all of Israel, and it was that way at the time that this demand for a king arose. And there's no doubt that this demand from many of Israel's tribal leaders reflected a hope that perhaps a king would become a uniting force for these 12 tribes. And these three factions consisted first of those 2.5 tribes who had decided centuries earlier to make their homes on the east side of the Jordan River. That was Reuben, Gad, and about half the clans that formed Manasseh. Then second of all, there was Judah and Simeon, who occupied the southern end of Canaan. And third, there was a coalition of about 8 tribes who occupied the fertile north. Now, it's not necessary that these factions, were enemies of one another. They certainly recognized that together they formed the nation that had been founded by their common forefather Jacob. But there were extremely serious rivalries. There were regular battles over autonomy, issues over which tribe ought to be preeminent over the other ones, unhappiness over their territorial boundaries that some thought were unfair. And there was this constant sniping at one another over who best and most purely represented the true people of God, and who were the true inheritors of what Moses and Joshua had founded. Now, I know I said this numerous times last week, but I don't think it's possible to overstate it. If we want to actually understand what is happening from this point forward in the Old Testament, we have to become students of history. And while God's providence directed mankind, and especially Israel, along a path with a very certain purpose and towards a predetermined goal, it did so largely unseen, very unnoticed, and in a miraculous conjunction with men's free will, somehow God's will was accomplished all along the way. But always, always, these great and seminal events that are recorded in the Bible as these marvelous stories that some of us recognize from our days in Sunday school were done within the context of a worldwide, of a national, of a family, and individual circumstances as they were at that time. Now, King Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. This is understandable in the political situation of that day, that a man from the tribe of Benjamin would be selected to be Israel's first king. Benjamin was in an interesting geographic location. They were kind of a buffer zone. Benjamin's southern border was Judah. Their northern border was Ephraim, or Ephraim Israel, the leader of the northern faction of tribes. And it put them in kind of an envious and a difficult position. There were loyalties within the various clans that formed the tribe of Benjamin that cut both ways, kind of not unlike our state of Virginia in our Civil War. At the same time, the territory of Benjamin lay in a militarily and a religiously strategic location. Some of Israel's most important and traditionally hallowed sacred sites lay in Benjamin's territory. And militarily, Benjamin's territory was along the Jordan River, and some of the best fording points were located right there. Thus, running through Benjamin was a very important highway and trade route. Now again, God operates providentially through mankind's daily circumstances. So what was logical from a political perspective that a man from Benjamin would become king. But what spiritual reason or purpose could there be for that selection? Well, there's a few we can consider. Now, according to the God pattern of map directions, compass directions, that are given to us in Scripture, east is always the most spiritually important. And next to that, the south. The north, on the other hand, was not only of the least status, but we'll also find that each time Israel was conquered by an empire, they were exiled to the north. And in the end times, where are Israel's enemies going to come from? The north. Where will the Battle of Armageddon be fought within Israel? In the north. Which tribes of Israel were conquered and assimilated into the Gentile world, those that we call the 10 lost tribes? The northern tribes. Benjamin was aligned with the northern faction of tribes who were the instigators of replacing God with a human king. Another consideration is that Jacob, on his deathbed, essentially placed Judah in the preeminent position to become the leader over all of the Israelite tribes. Judah was part of the southern coalition of tribes. And let's recall what Jacob said about Judah in Genesis 49 at the deathbed blessing of all of his 12 sons. He said this in Genesis 49:8, "Judah, your brothers will acknowledge you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. Judah is a lion's cub. My son, you stand over the prey. He crouches down and stretches like a lion, like a lioness. Who dares to provoke him? The scepter will not pass from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his legs, until he comes to whom obedience belongs, and it is he whom the peoples will obey. Tying his donkey to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice grapevine, he washes his clothes in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes." Thus it would be altogether inappropriate for these Hebrews who were rebelling against God by demanding to have a king to be effectively rewarded by initially getting the leader that God intended that they would eventually have, a ruler from the tribe of Judah, and thereby to receive all the blessings that would naturally accrue to it. On the other hand, Jacob also prophetically described, or can we even say divinely destined, the character of the tribe of Benjamin, and he did it in this way in Genesis 49:27. "Benjamin is a ravenous wolf, in the morning devouring the prey, in the evening still dividing the spoil." Being a ravenous wolf, whereby the riches of the spoils of war is his chief concern, is hardly a flattering description. And certainly it would not fit the divine ideal for a ruler over God's kingdom. But devouring the prey, meaning the weak, and amassing spoils, wealth, to be divided up among those who would be governing, is perhaps the most admired and desired characteristic of a human king. Let's read 1 Samuel chapter 11 together. Open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 11. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 308. First Samuel chapter 11. "Then Nahash the Ammonite came up and set up camp to fight Yabesh Gilead. All the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "If you'll make a treaty with us, we'll be your subjects." Nahash the Ammoni replied, "I'll do it on this condition, that all your right eyes will be gouged out, and thus you'll be disgraced on all Israel." The leaders of Jabesh answered him, "Give us 7 days' grace to send messengers throughout Israel's territory, and then if no one will rescue us, we'll surrender to you." The messengers came to Gibeah, where Shaul lived. And he said these words in the hearing of the people, and all the people cried out and wept. As this was going on, Saul came, following the oxen out of the field. And Saul asked, "What's wrong with the people to make them cry like that?" They told him what the men from Jabesh had said. And the Spirit of God fell upon Saul when he heard this, blazing furiously with anger. He seized a pair of oxen, he cut them into pieces, and then he sent them throughout the territory of Israel with messengers, saying, "Anyone who doesn't come and follow Shaul and Shmuel, this is what's going to be done to his oxen." The fear of Adonai fell on the people, and they came out with united hearts. He reviewed them in Bezek. There were 300,000 from the people of Israel. The men of Judah numbered 30,000. And to the messengers that had come, they said, "Tell the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you will have been rescued." The messengers returned and told the men of Jabesh, and they were overjoyed. And then the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Tomorrow we'll surrender to you, and you can do with us whatever you like." Well, the next day Saul divided the people into three companies. Then they entered the camp of the Ammoni during the morning watch and kept attacking until the heat of the day, until those who remained were so scattered that no two of them were left together. And the people said to Samuel, "Who are the men who said, 'Is Saul to rule over us? Hand them over to us so we can put them to death.'" But Saul said, "No one will be put to death today, because today Adonai has rescued Israel." Then Shmuel said to the people, "Come, let's go to Gilgal and inaugurate the kingship there." So all the people went to Gilgal. And there in Gilgal, before Adonai, they made Shaul king. They presented sacrifices as peace offerings before Adonai there. And there Saul and all the people of Israel celebrated with great joy. This chapter begins the transition from Samuel's judgeship to Saul's kingship. And of course, God's providence is very evident to us in hindsight, but undoubtedly it wasn't nearly as much so to King Saul or perhaps even Samuel. Now here's the situation. After his coronation at Mizpah, Saul returned home to, resume a regular life. So why didn't he immediately assume his role as king of Israel? Because there were an awful lot of influential Israelites who didn't want Saul to be the king. Or they just didn't want a king altogether. The main group of dissenters was from Judah and Simeon, those southern tribes, who knew full well that a king who was chosen from the northern alliance of tribes would, of course, give preference to his own constituency to the detriment of those who weren't part of that alliance, namely Judah and Simeon. Among human kings, perhaps his foremost purpose is to be a warlord. While this is prevalent and essential to all kingdoms, it's not nearly as important as it is to a tribal society. Because in tribal societies, there's a never-ending battle among the clans and the tribes for dominance. Warfare among the tribes is a given. Thus, a good and timely war is the perfect platform for a prince to prove his worth to become a king. Now, this would be a good time to point out another interesting but sometimes not so obvious dynamic that is going on here. Monarchies and tribalism don't mix very well. In other words, whereas the sovereignty of the tribal leader over his tribe and his duty to do everything possible to elevate his own tribe's status and dominance above all the others is at the heart of the tribal system. It's a king's goal to have the unwavering allegiance of all his subjects to him and to him alone, and to destroy all those who might have ambitions to usurp his throne or to demand autonomy. Further, it was necessary that a king set up a common justice system that all the kingdom obeyed, and it would be administered by the king's men, regardless of family ties and other loyalties. Israel consisted of 12 tribes, each one with its own tribal chief, who had no interest in giving up any of his sovereignty to a king. And among the tribes, it was the tribal leader who administered justice. So we have two different governing systems with two different governing philosophies and leadership agendas that are just about to butt heads here. If Israel was going to have a true and functional monarchy, tribalism was going to have to diminish. Fat chance. Now let me give you a modern day parallel so that you can get a good mental picture of why King Saul was doomed to never having peace and to his ultimate failure. In the early 18th century, a similar transition from pure tribalism to a monarchy was attempted in the Arabian Peninsula. But a kingship didn't become a reality there until the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. The Saud family, in the mid-1700s, became the head of a powerful tribe, and they dominated all the other tribes of Central Arabia with the rather typical goal of becoming the preeminent Arab tribe in all of Arabia and then eventually the entire Middle East. And as happens in tribalism, the other tribes fought against them. And so the Saud family's power diminished, and then it rose again, and then it diminished again, and it rose again multiple times in wave-like fashion. And eventually, just after 1900, a new generation of the Saud family openly sought to create a monarchy. And for the first time, their efforts generally succeeded. They used brutal means to put down these constant rebellions of all the various tribal leaders who had no interest in having a king over them. Today, the Saud ruling family of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia continues in that battle. Since the religion of Islam is a tribal and thus warfare-based religion, the various tribes of Saudi Arabia, who hate the decadent Saud monarchy, who live like rich playboys in their eyes, well, they're constantly trying to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia. It is this situation that brought about the likes of Osama bin Laden, a Saudi rebel. In fact, the rulers of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia are generally hated by the tribal Muslims throughout the Middle East, because the idea of a royal family ruling over them goes against both their tribal traditions and their Muslim religion. Thus, when oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia in the 1930s that would bring wealth beyond imagination into the royal family's coffers, the tribal leaders became all the more angry and jealous, and this drove the Saudi monarchy to make alliances with the West. The West wanted and needed that oil. They had powerful militaries, and the king and the thousands of his royal Saud family wanted to stay in power. It was a natural alliance. Thus, we see this uneasy but necessary relationship between the West and the King of Saudi Arabia, but also never-ending battles and violence and repression and Saudi Arabia, all wrapped around the traditional Muslim Arab tribal system, vying against the hated Saudi monarchy who takes away all of the tribal leaders' sovereignty. This is what King Saul was about to face. And he full well knew it, as did God. And of course, the tribal leaders of Israel, who demanded a king and had applauded this choice of Saul, saw only the benefits for themselves. But in the end, things never did work out very well for anybody, except Israel's enemies in this arrangement. And in chapter 11, verse 1, we are introduced to a fellow named Nahash, who was a king from the territory of Ammon. Now, it's always interesting in the Bible when we leap so suddenly and without warning from one scenario to the next, as we do here when we go directly from Saul's coronation to a war with King Nahash. Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls have shed a little bit of light on this passage. In the Dead Sea Scroll of Samuel, there was found a verse to begin this chapter that was heretofore unknown. It was either added by the Essenes or perhaps dropped by later Bible translators. There's a lot of speculation as to which is which, so we're not going to debate that. But here's that verse that was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls at the beginning of this chapter of Samuel. Now, Nahash, king of the Ammonites, had been grievously oppressing the Gadites and the Reubenites. He would gouge out the right eye of each of them and would not grant Israel a deliverer. No one was left of the Israelites across the Jordan whose right eye Nahash, king of the Ammonites, hadn't gouged out. But there were 7,000 men who had escaped from the Ammonites and had entered Jabesh Gilead. Then the words, after this passage found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, begin about 1 month later. Well, that appears before the start of the text that we all have in our modern Bibles. Now, I'm not sure this extra verse adds a whole lot, except that it tells us that it was only about a month from the time of Saul's inauguration at Mizpah until his opportunity to prove himself and to establish his merit to be Israel's king by rescuing Jabesh Gilead just fell into his lap. Now we'll also see that Jabesh Gilead had become something like a fortress of last resort for what remained of the tribe of Gad's and of the tribe of Reuben's warriors, since they had been chased there by this Nahash and his troops. Well, the Ammonites were descendants of Lot, nephew to Abraham. So they were Semites, descendants of Shem. And they were distant cousins of the Israelites. They lived to the east of the territory of Gad and Reuben. Their capital city was Rabbath Ammon, which, of course, today is known as the modern capital city of Ammon, capital of the kingdom of Jordan. Now, Jabesh Gilead, also called Jabesh Gilead, was a fortified city located east of the Jordan River in the territory of Gad. And apparently after the remnant of the combined forces of Gad and Reuben fled to Jabesh Gilead for safety, Nahash brought his Ammonite troops there and set up a siege. It was obvious to Gilead's leadership they had no hope of winning this battle at their current troop strength. So they chose the standard option for that era when you're faced with an unwinnable situation. They'd surrender with terms. Such surrender usually had benefit for both sides. The attacking force didn't waste time or resources in battle, nor did they heavily damage property that they wished to acquire. And the besieged didn't die, or they wouldn't lose their homes necessarily, or maybe not even their livelihoods. But Nahash wasn't a particularly agreeable fellow. His terms were that in return for not annihilating every last resident of Jabesh-Gilead was he'd blind the right eye of every Israelite male. Such a deal. His stated reason for doing this was to bring disgrace upon all Israel, or in most Bibles, to bring reproach upon all Israel. One needs to understand Middle Eastern terms and culture to appreciate the savage irony that Nahash is insisting upon. Now, although in many translations we'll see the word treaty used here, if you will make a treaty with us, in fact, the word in Hebrew is berit, which is usually more translated as a covenant. And a treaty is a covenant, and a covenant is a treaty, so those were interchangeable terms in that era. And as I'm sure you'll recall, a covenant was always sealed in blood. An animal sacrificed. It was cut up, and then the local god's name was invoked as an oath to bind that covenant. Thus, the standard biblical terminology was to cut a covenant. Cut was not a synonym for make. It simply incorporated the idea of cutting up an animal. If an animal was not ritually cut up, there was no covenant. And so Nahash is saying sarcastically, "Oh, I'll cut a covenant with you, all right, but what we're going to cut up to seal the treaty isn't going to be an animal. Instead, it's going to be each and every Israelite's right eye. That's going to be the flesh and blood used to seal the covenant." Well, to have an eye gouged out is one thing. To have your right eye gouged out is quite another. The right side of anything was always regarded as the best side, the most powerful side. So to have one's right eye removed, well, that brought on the greatest shame. Now, why was Nahash so intent in inflicting such harm like this on Israel? He hated them. In fact, no specific reason is given for this hatred. But undoubtedly, it was born centuries earlier when his Ammonite ancestors were ejected from their land by Moses and Joshua. All over our planet, we will find wars over land that changed hands scores, if not hundreds of years earlier. We have a similar case going on in Israel today. But what we need to notice is this almost irrational hatred of Israel that was harbored by King Nahash. Other than the typical tribal skirmishes that occurred on a regular basis, there's nothing to suggest that Gad or Reuben had been unusually hard on their neighbors to the east, Ammon. So why was Nahash intent on doling out such severe retribution against these men of Gilead that he saw as a means of symbolically humiliating all Israel? See, rather, this hatred is the most inexplicable kind that we've seen for centuries, actually, against the Jewish people and now against the state of Israel. By cutting a covenant, a treaty, with the leaders of Jabesh-Gilead, essentially a vassal agreement would have been created, whereby the city of Jabesh-Gilead would owe tribute to Nahash. Now, it was usual that foreign kings of that era were mainly seeking tribute, another source of income, when they would march against other cities. Most of the time, they were only too happy to allow the current king of that city to stay in his position as long as he bowed down to the conqueror, kept the peace, and then paid all the required taxes and tribute, because keeping the current king in place and the city intact kept the economy running. These weren't stupid people. But to gouge out the right eye of every male of Gilead would do nothing but greatly reduced the amount of tribute that was possible. But it's the nature of hatred to be destructively irrational, is it not? We saw it with Pharaoh. We saw it with Hitler. And we see it today with Hezbollah, Hamas, Fatah, the Islamic Brotherhood, the bulk of Islam that is willing to give up anything to destroy Israel. Anything. Everything short of turning Israel over lock, stock, and barrel to her enemies has been offered in hopes of achieving peace, and every time it's turned down. When in 2005 Israel gave up the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians, the first thing the Palestinians did was to go on a rampage and destroy all the fabulous greenhouses Israel had built and grown so much food in. Then they started destroying the public buildings, the schools, the infrastructure that now belonged to them. Then, after they had destroyed almost all of their food-growing capacity, they sat down in the remains and complained that they were starving. They had no jobs. And Israel and the world needed to give them food and money. Now that is irrational hatred. Now, although I'm not a fan of his, I remember seeing a short news clip a few years ago of Phil Donahue, a TV talk show host, where he was holding a kind of a forum specifically on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And after about an hour of this discussion, when it was becoming apparent that there was utterly no solution possible that could even reasonably satisfy both sides, he just exploded in frustration and said that in all his life he'd never seen such an insane situation, where the only thing that seemed to guide the decisions was hatred. Hatred that was so intractable that one side was literally willing to destroy itself if it meant it could also destroy the other side. That's the underlying reason that here in 1 Samuel chapter 11, that Nahash attacked Jabesh Gilead and then wanted to gouge out their right eyes. He hated the Hebrew people. Well, in verse 3, the leaders of Jabesh Gilead asked Nahash if he'll allow them to send to Israel for help. And then if in 7 days nothing comes, they'll accept Nahash's horrible terms. Now, while such an odd request and an agreement from Nahash to allow it is difficult for us to fathom, we have to understand that Nahash's purpose was to humiliate. So he was more than happy for the news of what was going on here to get out. Further, I think he suspected that Jabesh Gilead wasn't going to get any help from Israel, and for a very good reason. More than a century earlier, they had refused to answer the call to arms to punish the tribe of Benjamin for the sexual attack upon a Levite's concubine in the city of Gibeah, a major city in the territory of Benjamin, and it resulted in her death. Besides, a siege is a long-lasting event. It can be months. So a week in that light is a pretty short period of time. Well, messengers are sent from Jabesh Gilead to Gibeah to plead for help. Now, Gibeah, the same Gibeah where that terrible concubine incident had occurred so long ago, this was where Saul lived. This was his hometown. And we're told in verse 4 that the people of Gibeah wailed and cried when they heard this news. Now, this certainly was not a happy day, but why this strong reaction of sadness and grief from the people of the city of Gibeah? They were a long way from Jabesh Gilead, 40 miles. So they were in no immediate danger. There's no indication that Nahash had an intention or made any threat of crossing over the Jordan River to attack any of the other tribes on the west side. And since Gibeah was of the tribe of Benjamin, and Jabesh Gilead consisted of Gadites and Reubenites, on the surface it's pretty hard to understand this depth of anguish of the Benjamite residents of Gibeah. Concern? Sure. Despair? Why? Well, here's where some history explains yet another Bible story. Turn your Bibles to Judges chapter 20. Judges chapter 20. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 294. You just got to thumb back a few pages. Judges chapter 20. We're going to read verses 1 through 11 and then 43 to 46. All the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including Gilead. The community assembled with one accord before Adonai at Mizpah. The leaders of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers with swords. Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the people of Israel said, "Tell us, how was this crime committed?" The Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, answered, "I came to Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine, just to stay the night. And the men of Gibeah attacked me, and they surrounded the house I was staying at in the night. They wanted to kill me, but instead they raped my concubine to death. So I took my concubine's body, I cut her into pieces, and sent them throughout all the territories belonging to Israel, because they committed a shockingly obscene and degrading crime in Israel. Look, you are all people of Israel, so discuss what to do and give your advice here and now." And all the people stood up in agreement and said, "None of us will go home to his tent or his house. What we will now do to Gibeah is this. We'll draw lots. We'll take 10 men out of each 100 throughout the tribes of Israel, and 100 out of 1,000, and 1,000 out of 10,000 to collect food for the others. And when these come to Gibeah of Benjamin, they will avenge the crime that was committed." Thus all the men of Israel joined together in complete agreement, and they assembled to attack the city. All right, let's move on down now to verses 43 to 46. They surrounded the men of Benjamin, chased them, and trampled them down across from Gibeah on the east. 18,000 men of Benjamin fell, all of them experienced soldiers. They turned and fled towards the desert to the rock of Rimmon, and 5,000 of them were killed on the roads. Then they followed them to Gidom, killed another 2,000. Thus, the total number of Benjamin who fell that day was 25,000 experienced sword-bearing soldiers. Now, move over to Judges 21. We're going to read just the first three verses. The men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah that none of them would let his daughter marry a man from Benjamin. And the people came to Bethel, and they stayed there before God till evening, crying and weeping. And they said, "Adonai, why has this come about in Israel? Why should there be today in Israel one tribe missing?" Now moving on to verse 8. Then they asked who from the tribes of Israel had not come up to Adonai at Mizpah, and found that none had come from Yavesh Gilead to the camp where the assembly was, since when the people were counted, none of the inhabitants of Yavesh Gilead were found. So the gathering sent 12,000 warriors there and ordered them, "Go and put the people who live in Yavesh Gilead to death with the sword, including women and children. Completely destroy every man, every woman who has had sex with a man." And among the inhabitants of Yavesh Gilead, they found 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Then the whole gathering sent a message proclaiming peace to the people of Benjamin who were at the Rock of Rimmon. So Benjamin returned at that time, and the people of Israel gave them the women that they had kept alive of the women from Jabesh Gilead, but there weren't enough for them. So there you have it. When, many years earlier, all of Israel had gathered together in one accord to destroy the tribe of Benjamin, for their Sodom-like behavior at Gibeah when they ravaged to death this Levite's concubine, the city of Yavesh Gilead refused to join the fight. Thus, after the tribe of Benjamin was decimated by this huge combined armies of all the Israelite tribes, the Israelite warriors then launched a reprisal against the city of Jabesh Gilead for what they considered to be treasonous behavior, and they killed most of the inhabitants of the city. And during the process, Israel captured 400 young unmarried girls from Jabesh Gilead and later gave them as wives to the few remaining inhabitants of Gibeah of Benjamin, so the tribe of Benjamin wouldn't entirely die out. The result was that Yavesh Gilead and Gibeah had close family ties. Lots of intermarriage had taken place. Most of the inhabitants of the two cities were now closely related by blood. Most of them were in-laws. The majority of the children born from that time forward to the tribe of Benjamin after this judges incident had mothers that were from the tribe of Gad, fathers that were from the tribe of Benjamin. And further, since Yavesh Gilead had essentially sided with Benjamin when no one else would, there was now a close bond between these folks, as one can easily imagine. But there was also a less than cordial relationship between Yavesh Gilead and the rest of Israel, who had mercilessly attacked them just because they refused to participate in a war. So, the completely logical place that these messengers would be sent to rescue Jabesh Gilead was Gibeah of Benjamin, because they were family. And in many ways, the residents of Gibeah owed a century-old debt of gratitude to these residents of Yavesh Gilead, and this also explains this high level of shock and anguish by the residents of Gibeah when they heard this news from those messengers that had come from Yavesh Gilead. This story begins to take on a different and deeper dimension when we understand all this, doesn't it? See, there's reasons for these things that happen in the Bible. And there's going to be a lot more fascinating ties like this that I'll point out as we proceed. Now, verse 5 explains that Shaul was out plowing fields with oxen when these messengers arrived at Gibeah. And the wailing was so loud that he heard it as he was approaching the city. And we're told that upon hearing the nature of the trouble, he became highly agitated and angry. Now, the usual explanation for this anger is that it was a righteous anger that resulted from the Spirit of God coming upon him. But when we understand the simple fact that the community that he was part of, Gibeah, and therefore much of his own family had aunts and uncles and cousins and children and in-laws and close friends who were under attack and in grave danger, now we have to question whether this was a truly righteous anger that was the result of the Spirit of God coming upon him, or was it something else? I think it was not the anger, but it was the resolve to do something about this pending catastrophe, along with a new and divine capability to lead men into battle, when there's no evidence Saul had any leadership, let alone any military experience. I think that's what the Holy Spirit gave to him. Now, Saul's response to all this was a strange one. He goes out and cuts up his oxen, and he sends pieces of them off to the other tribes, along with a message that they're to muster for battle against Nachash, and anybody who refuses is going to have this happen to their oxen, along with a not-so-subtle hint that they might personally also suffer that same fate. Now, where might have Saul got that idea? Well, let's go back to the book of Judges. Judges 19, starting at verse 25. However, the men wouldn't listen to him, so the man took hold of his concubine, and he brought her out to them. And they raped her and abused her all night long. Only at dawn did they finally let her go. At daybreak, the woman came, and she fell down at the door of the man's house where her husband was. She was still there when it grew light. When her husband got up and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, he saw the woman lying there with her hands stretched out towards the door, and he said, "Get up, let's go." There was no answer. So he loaded her body on a donkey and began his trip home. And on arrival at his house, he got a knife, and he took hold of his concubine's body, and he cut her up into 12 pieces and sent them to all the regions of Israel. Everyone who saw it said, "From the day the people of Israel came up to Egypt until now, never has such a thing happened or been seen. What are we going to do about it? Talk it over and decide." As we conclude today, I want to point out again, these Bible stories don't happen in isolation. There were reasons these people did what they did. But this decision to cut up the oxen doesn't bode well for Saul. What that Levite did in dismembering his concubine's body and sending it all over Israel is so disgusting, it's hard to quantify. That Saul would essentially use the same message only with oxen is certainly not as blood-curdling or full of sin, but it isn't very edifying either. Don't think that the people of Israel didn't perfectly understand this implication and parallel. That was for sure the reason Saul did it. We have this occurring even from the same city where that concubine incident happened. And we have Benjamin and we have Yavash Gilead again in the middle of this thing. See, we must always watch for patterns. That's what will always lead us to the truth.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.